Welcome to Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters. We'll talk about tomorrow's vote in the FCC, which is expected to deregulate further the media. In 1966, under the Communications Act, radio was deregulated, and now commercial radio is essentially controlled by two monopolies, Clear Channel and Viacom Infinity. And the same will inexorably happen with television and newspapers and various towns, various states, particularly the smaller states, all of whom have two senators, as you know, will essentially have one or two media moguls per state deciding who gets elected, who to the Senate and the House. And essentially the politics of this country will be in the hands of a handful of moguls. And as H.L. Mencken says, any billionaire in America has freedom of speech by simply owning the media. And we will also talk with Nicholas Johnson, a former FCC commissioner. We'll speak with a senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity, Bob Williams, who broke the story about the extraordinary amount of freebies that the FCC has been receiving from the media companies, free corporate jets, hotels, luxury hotels, etc., and also the extraordinary number of meetings had with the moguls and virtually no meetings with public interest groups. And when the public has had even learned about this issue, they have made it resoundingly clear that they disapprove of the media being controlled by fewer and fewer moguls. We'll also talk with John Nichols, who is the author of Our Media, Not Theirs, talking about the FCC vote, which is expected tomorrow. The vote's coming tomorrow, there's no question, but the expectation is that Michael Powell, the chairman of the FCC, will remove all of the caps and restrictions on cross-ownership of media, of newspapers and television. And already here in Los Angeles, under the existing rules, CBS owns two of the television stations. Fox owns two of the television stations. If you just see what happened to radio in 1996 under the Telecommunications Act, it was deregulated. Now about 80% of all radio, commercial radio in this country, is controlled by two companies. This is truly heading towards a bizarre mirror of the Soviet system, where you have, in this case, you have capitalist monopolies, but in the case of Fox News, they are essentially the Pravda of the Republican Party. This can't be good for democracy. It can't be good for diversity of opinion. It is essentially un-American, but it is happening. And let's look at to why it's happening and how to stop it, if it can be stopped. First of all, Bob Williams, you're a senior writer with the Center for Public Integrity. You just, in the last week or so, you revealed how much Michael Powell has been on the take, how much the media moguls have provided him with free executive jets, hotels, meals. He's been comped all over the country here. And we're also joined by John Nichols. And just beginning with you, Bob, how many meetings has Michael Powell had with the media moguls versus public interest groups?
Well, Michael Powell himself has not had all that many meetings, but other members of the FCC commissioners have had quite a few meetings. Powell himself has had four meetings, those meetings were with the companies that stand to gain the most on this vote: Viacom, Fox News, those types of companies. But the other FCC commissioners, there has only been one public meeting on this, and these private meetings, which are called ex parte meetings. It's kind of how the FCC does business. And what they do is, a company asks for a meeting, and it's granted, and the only public notice of those types of meetings is after the fact, and no records are kept, and There's a small summary that the company is required to file, but it doesn't tell you much.
And John Nichols, co-author of Our Media, Not Theirs, you've obviously seen the report that Bob Williams has put together. I mean, a clear conflict of interest here, isn't it?
Yeah.
if that's not a too kind description.
Well, I cover politics. That's what I do for a living, and so we like to use, you know, the more cautious terminology. So I like corruption, illegality, massive stretching of the rules to a point which they've broken. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I have read Bob's work, and he's far too cautious in describing it because he's such
But Bob's a non-profit, non-partisan organization.
Well, he's such a responsible guy that he's very cautious and correct in describing it, and I respect him for that, but I've got to tell you, I've read through the stuff that the center has done, and it's blown my mind. I've covered the FCC for years. I've dealt with these issues in all sorts of different settings, and yet I had no idea that things had gone to the extent that they have. These people have taken 2,500 paid trips at the expense of the folks that they regulate. While Bob points out that Michael Powell only met four times personally with the people lobbying on this, it should be noted that one of the people that he was able to fit into that busy schedule was Rupert Murdoch. I mean, these are the people he met were the most powerful of the players in this. And what's notable is, if you look in Bob's very good report at Michael Powell's staff, you will find that key staffers from Powell met many, many more times with all these folks. And the bottom line is this. In these secret closed-door meetings with the people they're supposed to regulate, you add those up, you get 71 of these types of meetings. If you add up the meetings with the public sector, the public interest, with folks who are advocating, lobbying on behalf of citizens, and on behalf of journalists, on behalf of communities, anybody who doesn't have like a profit motive in this, there were only, if I'm right, 5 meetings. So 71 closed-door meetings with the people who are going to make a buck, 5 meetings with everybody else.
Well, it's interesting, gentlemen, to note that the former chairman of the FCC, Reed Hunt, in an interview with Salon magazine, it's up on their website now, he basically, in asking the question, who will be the big winners, he said, well, the conservative movement owns the FCC, the courts, the Congress, the White House. And he's basically suggesting that this is really a political move. This is the consolidation of a political revolution on the part of the conservatives. Let me bring in the former FCC commissioner, Nicholas Johnson. Are you with us?
I am indeed, Ian. I am proud to be with you. I've been listening on the Internet.
Oh, you
if
have.
If you wish to prove to your station how popular you are nationwide, beyond the Los Angeles reach.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I know that I'm transgressing as a neutral media commentator here. I'm displaying my true feelings here. You know, they talk about a liberal bias in the media. I wish that that people really understood some of these terms. I mean, liberal doesn't mean open-minded, skeptical. Isn't that what a reporter is supposed to be?
One would hope.
I mean, I thought that was the general idea, inquiry. I don't see much difference between reporters and intelligence officers. They're both trying to do the same thing. They're trying to provide the truth with as
well. I would say neither has been doing a very good job in this country in the past few months.
Well, tell me what you think, Nicholas Johnson, about. I know tomorrow we're going to. Nobody's going to be surprised to learn that the rest of the store has been given away to the media moguls.
That's right.
But why is this process been inexorably going on? And how is it that a few handful of people have taken over the entire media, which the airwaves belong to the people?
Well, that was certainly the original theory, and indeed, back in 1926. when nobody really knew what was inside this black box and what it could do and what power it would have, Congress was prescient enough to see the risks that we run with media concentration. Congressman Luther Johnson of Texas said on the floor of the House when they were debating the Radio Act of 1927, as it became, he said, if we should ever allow such a great power to fall into the hands of the few, then woe be to those who would dare to disagree with him. Well, woe be indeed. He was absolutely right. And why what could be seen with such clarity at a time when nobody knew what radio was or would become, why, when he could see it then, can the FCC and the Congress not see it now? And the answer, of course, is that they can see it, and that you put your finger on it in terms of the control of the media. The fewer hands it falls into, the greater the relative power of the government and the interrelationship between the government and the corporate interests. I would say, other than Pravda, I would use the analogy of Mussolini's Italy, when he had a council of corporations. The primary difference was Mussolini kept more power in government than Bush is willing to do, although corporations certainly played a major role in Mussolini's fascist state. And the other difference was that Mussolini was prepared to keep social programs in place that Bush wants to remove, which is apparently the primary purpose of the tax cuts that are not even welcomed by the rich, it's Financial Times in London that has projected we are headed to a $40 trillion national debt. And when you have no money, then obviously you cut social programs and leave nothing but the Defense Department, which seems to be their goal. And in order to accomplish that in a democratic society, you need to have control of the media. And the fewer the people are who you need to deal with, the easier that is to do. As Ted Turner pointed out in his op-ed yesterday or the day before, we now have five firms that are controlling about 90% of the news and views that reach the American people. And you have an outfit like Fox in China that was quite prepared to take BBC off of its satellite distribution service because the Chinese government was complaining about it. And you do get very close to what you were describing earlier with a Republican media outlet, basically. As the bumper sticker has it, the liberal media are as liberal as their conservative owners permit them to be.
John Nichols, your book, Our Media, Not Theirs, in terms of the vote tomorrow, do you think that there is either something that's implicit or complicit in this? Because if George W., no, let's forget about Michael Powell, but sure, because George W. is in charge of this administration, if he's going to give a huge windfall to the media moguls, do you think that George Bush gets something back in return?
Well, he gets two things back in return, and I think it's important to understand, as I'm sure Nick Johnson, who's one of my real heroes and who I'm sad didn't finish off his FCC tenure by getting elected to Congress or the Senate. We could have used him. But as Nick Johnson will tell you, when you deal with the FCC rule changes, you're dealing not just with ideology and biases, you're also dealing with structures. And here's where the conservatives are going to come out way ahead, not just George W. Bush, but conservatives in general. When you create a system in which it's easier for very large corporations to control more and more of the media, not just in individual markets, but really across the country, then it becomes a situation where you lose the discourse that would have existed with even between two or three or four or five media corporations. And the result of that is that you've got one big media company producing all the news, most of the culture in a community or even a region. And all that a government entity has to do then is play to that company, make sure that its taxes are low, that it's taken care of well. And you essentially have a symbiotic relationship. The Republicans, and particularly the Bush people, are very excited about developing those sorts of relationships because, remember, they pioneered this in Texas. Clear Channel is based in San Antonio, Texas, and the Clear Channel executives have been close to the Bush folks and their political team for more than a decade. And so they see a model that can work for them, not just in 2004, but really from here on out. And to be honest, that model might benefit a conservative Democrat as well. The people that it will never benefit, and this is the essential thing to remember, is the great mass of Americans. It will never benefit blacks, Hispanics, other people of color. It won't benefit low-income folks, because a one-size-fits-all homogenized media will always talk to the rich and to the folks who are paying the bills, not to the folks who are viewing it. Because there's no longer the sort of competition that would threaten them, where they would have to be entertaining or informative or useful. They can become the pablum or the vast wasteland that another former FCC Commissioner Newton Minow predicted.
Let me get a return to former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson. Let me just quote to you, Nicholas Johnson, from this interview with Reed Hunt, the former chair of the FCC, where he's suggests here, it's a different world today. Progressives would be better off going to a Ouija board to channel the spirits of Upton Sinclair and Ida Tarbell rather than to try to shake the conservative majority at the FCC. There's no way the three votes there are going to be altered in any way by any kind of popular protest. You can walk the streets of the United States and you will never find a single person who's in favor of more consolidated media unless by chance you happen to bump into one of Rupert Murdoch's children. I mean, this is a, where is, if the vote tomorrow is as predicted to give away the rest of the store to the few media moguls, what can stop it? And is there any legal mechanism or constitutional mechanism here?
Well, let me say a word about legal and constitutional mechanisms, because in point of fact, as god-awful as this increase in ownership limits is, and it is totally outrageous, it pales by comparison. It becomes almost a red herring compared to what the problem really is. The problem comes from about four factors, one of which is that the Supreme Court has made abundantly clear with regard to all media that there are no First Amendment rights except for owners. Journalists don't have First Amendment rights. Editors don't have First Amendment rights. They can be fired at will because the owner doesn't like their views. Nor do members of the public have First Amendment rights. You may, as a matter of grace, have your letter to the editor published by the Los Angeles Times, but if they won't publish it and you want to buy space in the Los Angeles Times, and they have posted rates and they sell space, they can make a content-based decision that they are not going to run your ad and not going to take your money, and you are totally shut out of the major print circulation medium throughout that 8,000-square-mile area. The Supreme Court has said the same thing with regard to radio and television, buying time on them. You cannot buy time if they don't want to sell it to you. We're not even talking now about free time, mind you. We're talking about paying. An outfit that's in the business of selling time. And they have, the Supreme Court says, the constitutional right to censor you off of the airwaves. The same thing for cable television. The same thing for the billing envelope of PG&E, which we got the California Public Utilities Commission to say we ought to be able to, as subscribers, put messages in that envelope since we're paying for it. The Supreme Court overruled that. All right? So couple that with the FCC's willingness to let the people who own the distribution medium, a cable television system, an over-the-air network, the same people who own the distribution system can own the content that flows over that distribution system, in addition to their having this censorship power. So compare this with AT&T, which was a literal monopoly before it was broken up. Anybody who wanted a phone could get one. Once you got one, you could say anything you wanted to over the phone. You might get in trouble with the FBI, but you weren't going to get in trouble with AT&T because they had no control of content. They controlled the conduit. They did not control the content. At that point, it made no difference for free speech purposes that there was just one owner. We're talking about five owners and complaining about that, as well we should. But the reason that makes it so bad is this combination of the Supreme Court's decision that we don't have any First Amendment rights unless we discover $200 million in spare pocket change one day and go out and buy our own station, and that the people that own the stations and the cable systems and whatever can control the content as well as the conduit. The third factor is that we now are building not just owners of enormous numbers of stations, like Clear Channel with over 100 radio stations.
I have 1,200.
Well, whatever. But I'm saying it's well over 1,000. It just, you know, sounds like a big number. And it is a big number. But the real problem is that these global conglomerate media corporations own not just all these radio and television stations. They own book publishers. They own movie studios. They own television networks. They own the magazines that comment about the movies and the books. They own the cable systems. They own the video and DVD manufacturing and rental and sale operations. And they own overseas media distribution systems. So that they are able to engage in what they call synergy, and I call hype of superstars, that drives out the range of creativity that I think Mr. Nichols was talking about. I can't really hear on my telephone what he's saying. But so it's driving out the new creativity that comes along. So it's not just a news and public affairs issue. Finally, we used to have community standards for these stations. In exchange for making private profit from the use of public property, they were to provide local news, public affairs, events, lost dogs, new babies, whatever, as local service. The FCC talked in terms of integration of ownership and management. In other words, the licensee would have a license to only one station in the community where they lived, and the owner would actually operate the station. That was the concept of local service. All that's gone now. So there is really no meaningful responsibility on an over-the-air station to provide service to its community. And finally, the Fairness Doctrine, which was never a very stringent standard. It didn't require anything that a professional journalist wouldn't do as a matter of course, namely cover controversy and present a range of views about the controversy. The FCC has repealed the Fairness Doctrine. So it's when you put these five factors together that you have the problem. I mean, going from an ability to own enough stations to reach 35% of the American homes and going from that to 45% of the American homes, is that awful? Yeah, of course it's god awful. Yeah. But somebody should have been talking about this back in the 1970s, not in the year 2003, because that's when the 70s and 80s this problem began of larger and larger ownership permissions, the abolition of citizens' First Amendment rights, the overturn of the Fairness Doctrine, the reduction of any community service, the growing conglomerate of multimedia with print and broadcast and so forth, this ownership of content and conduit, and the evolution of these Supreme Court standards. So it's, well, that package that creates the problem, and focusing on ownership, you know, somebody legitimately can say, you know, what's the big deal going from 35 to 45%?
Well, I think the thing that worries me more than anything, though, is that as people, the main tool of information and political organization for the vast majority of the people nowadays, and particularly in terms of dissent and alternatives to the media, is the internet. And the internet is accessed by dial-up, by a common carrier, by what you're talking about, Nicholas Johnson, by that like the phone companies. They don't regulate content. They're just a common carrier. But as broadband takes over the internet and satellite, and now Murdoch is able to buy the satellite monopoly as well, and eight companies, I think, own 90% of broadband, they can regulate content. It's not the internet will no longer be free as it is now. And just a word here with Bob Williams.
Fascinating discussion.
Well, I'm glad. Bob, you're at the Center for Public Integrity. You've revealed the extraordinary amount of freebies that Michael Powell and the other commissioners have gotten from the media moguls. But isn't there also another conflict of interest here? Isn't the and I know that this is what Chuck Lewis and you have been doing for a long time, looking into campaign finance reform. Isn't it true that the reason that we have this bazaar in Washington where congressmen and senators spend 80% of their time raising money and 20% of their time doing the people's business is because they essentially raise all of that campaign money and then hand it over to the television and radio stations to get reelected.
Absolutely. And that's a you know, symbiotic relationship that you know, is growing stronger every election campaign. I mean, if Bush is talking about coming up with a couple of $100 million this, you know, for this next election, and the vast majority of that would go to broadcast advertising.
So that it's not in their interest to reform the system at all.
Well, it's not in their interest. You would have to depend on them to do the right thing.
And John Nichols, do you think that there's any chance that the people can find an alternative? If indeed I'm correct in predicting that the last avenue of information and dissent, for example, a group like MoveOn.org had a profound effect on Wellstone's race before he was killed in the plane crash. Money was pouring in because of their activism. If these monopolies take over, the broadband monopolies, there's nothing to stop them from dropping MoveOn.org.
Well, Ian, you're starting to make me very depressed here. I think that it's an important point here to kind of tie up some of the many strings that we've laid out, and to tell people a couple of critical things that they need to know about this process, about what's been going on. Nick Johnson, who is brilliant and who is so good at laying out all of the crises here, actually in the midst of his comments a minute ago pointed to the biggest crisis of all, which is that citizens during the 1970s and 1980s were not effectively organized to challenge media conglomerates and challenge the politicians who served those media conglomerates on these issues. There was not the level of organization that we needed to make media ownership, media control, free press, free speech, political issues, which they should be, and which they are in many other countries around the world. What the FCC folks and their media conglomerate buddies did this spring was something that we were unable to do, those of us who cared about these issues for a long time before this, and that was they made media ownership, media control, an issue. We have tens of thousands of people who've actually gone into the streets in demonstrations, driven in part because of the terrible war coverage, but also because of these rule changes. We now have over 500,000 people who have communicated with the FCC through emails, letters, postcards, and just in recent weeks, MoveOn.org brought in more than 200,000. The National Rifle Association, and remember, there are conservative groups, sincere conservative groups, not corporatists, who don't want this either. They brought in 300,000. The fact of the matter is that citizens are more engaged with this issue than ever before, and there is a road out. The FCC does make rule changes, but much of what the FCC does, in fact, most of it, can be overturned by Congress. Now, right now, we've got a horrible Congress. There's no doubt of that, and I'm not predicting that tomorrow or the next day Congress is going to come in and say to the FCC, you did the wrong thing. But what I am saying is that we're at a point now, and I think a very critical point in our history, where we can make media a part of the palette of issues that we care about. You know, somebody cares about abortion rights. That's good. Somebody cares about taking care of, making sure we have Head Start programs. That's great. Somebody cares about war and peace. That's great. Now we can make media another of those issues and to hold politicians accountable on it. What's exciting to me is more than 100 members of Congress, including many from the L.A. area, the best of all being Diane Watson, have come forward to oppose doing these rule changes at this time. More than 20 members of the U.S. Senate, including some conservatives, have come forward to oppose these rule changes. We have the basis for a political movement based around issues of media reform, and we can't let the coalitions that have been built to fight these changes fall apart on Monday afternoon. We've got to hold them together, and that takes us to the second component here. The way that we hold these movements together is to use the tools we have to keep people informed. The anti-war movement of this late winter, early spring, was a success because as bad as our media is today, people found vehicles to get information. And one of the most critical vehicles for information in Southern California is your show. To make media an issue and to make it possible to begin to reverse a lot of the things that Nick Johnson was talking about a couple minutes ago. I know after this spring that it is possible because I've seen the energy and the passion of people when they get informed about these issues.
This is should not be a country of the rich, for the rich, and by the rich. This is still supposed to be America.
And Ian, can I put in an amen, brother, on that last statement? 30 years ago, when I was putting together media reform coalitions, one of the lines I used was, whatever is your first priority, women's rights, environment, abortion rights, whatever, your second priority has to be media reform, because with it you have at least a chance, and without it you have no chance whatsoever.
Well, and I noticed
that seemed to catch on, and I think that's a point that can be made to, because many people say, "Oh, I've got my priorities already. I'm trying to save the whales, or I'm working for women's rights or civil rights or whatever." But I think the point you make is that that's fine, and that's terribly important, but in order to give you a multiplier in terms of your effectiveness, think in terms of what we need to do in order to maintain some kind of democratic control over the media.
Well, I notice here in the interview with Reed Hunt, the former FCC chair, he said that Dwight Eisenhower was talking about when he warned against the military-industrial complex in his last speech before leaving office. If Dwight Eisenhower were alive today, he'd be warning us about the dangers of the military-industrial media complex. Now, is there any way that you can form a coalition of liberals and conservatives over this common understanding about the Democratic town square?
Ian, let me answer your question.
John Nichols.
We've done it. The coalition has been formed. The challenge is not to form it. The challenge now is to hold it together. If we can hold together the people who have engaged with this fight over the FCC changes, we're well on our way to where we need to be. I was at the FCC last Tuesday. I testified at an informal hearing organized by the two progressive commissioners, the two people who serve in the tradition of Nick Johnson, and that's Commissioner Michael Copps and Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. And we had around the table more than 25 groups, many of them longtime media reform groups like Center for Digital Democracy, our group Free Press, which is you can go and find on the web at mediareform.net, and lots of other folks who've been around, but lots of new groups. We had the Leadership Council on Civil Rights. We had the National Association of Black Journalists, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. We had NOW and Common Cause and MoveOn.org, but we also had the National Rifle Association. We had the Catholic bishops. We had the Parents Resource Council. We had all sorts of the conservative, real kind of more, I guess if you say, for lack of a better way of saying it, the non-corporate conservative groups. And one of the most conservative players in the country, Brent Bozell, was sitting next to the vice president of NOW. And he said, when you get the vice president of NOW next to a 30-year anti-abortion campaigner like me, talking about this guy, said, when you got us sitting together saying the same thing, one of two things have happened. Either the earth has spun off its axis and we have all lost our minds, or there is a crisis coming toward us that we have to respond to like a natural disaster, not like a political or ideological event, but a natural disaster. And when you see that, you forget about, you know, whether my side ideologically comes out ahead or your side, because you say there's going to be nothing left. And the fact of the matter is, liberals, conservatives, progressives, right-wingers, anybody who's not a crook has come forward and said, these rule changes are bad. If we can continue to hold together that coalition of folks who say, we want an honest town square, we want a media where every voice can be heard, because we genuinely believe our side will win in that debate, then we're going to be in good shape. I also, one final thing I will emphasize here. I don't think the coalition is going away, because one of the striking things about this is the anger that I see in people when I go around the country. You know, Bob McChesney and I have been working on these issues for years, not nearly as long as Nick Johnson. But we used to go out, and we were lucky, maybe we'd get 50 people to come out and hear us give a talk. This, since January of this year, we haven't given a talk where there weren't more than 400 or 500 people, sometimes 600, 700, 800. Last night, I spoke to 1,200 people at a meeting on this issue. Folks are engaged, they're excited, and they come from across the political spectrum because they know that having their media controlled by a handful of people living in distant cities who are only interested in making a buck is not healthy for democracy, and it's not healthy for them no matter what they believe.
Let me again remind the audience that this is KPFK Los Angeles. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. We've got a former FCC commissioner who tried to serve the public and did. Don't you think, though, Nick Johnson, that there is a clear and present connection here between what we've seen so far in terms of the consolidation of the media into the hands of a few moguls, most of whom or all of whom are right-wing? Doesn't that track with the political move to the right in the last few years as well, or the last, 5 or 6 years?
Oh, absolutely. And at the risk of being charged with being a conspiratorial theorist, I don't think it's an accident. And in that connection, let me draw an analogy in support of what was just said. Draw an analogy to the tax cut. Bush asks for a $750 billion tax cut at a time when, in every other war in history, we've raised taxes, right? So what is the compromise? Well, how did we win? Well, we're only going to have a $350 billion tax cut. Well, we're still not having a tax increase. We're still having a tax cut. So here, let's suppose we win this fight. What do we get? Well, instead of a single owner being able to reach 45% of the American homes, they can only reach 35% of the American homes. Well, what they ought to do is have one station each. I mean, what's this 35%? That's no victory. So I would agree that as we have this coalition, we need to move the thinking of people well beyond simply the issue of 45% to 35%. And let's talk about some of those other five factors I mentioned. And in connection with the Internet, which has been mentioned in a variety of contexts, I think that has proven to be one of our most effective organizing tools and still can, at least on this day as we speak. And in that connection, I have a web page where I have thousands of things that I've written, including the entirety of a couple books, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set and Test Pattern for Living, that everything's free for the downloading, obviously, at www.nicholasjohnson.org, www.nicholasjohnson.org. So if anybody wants to continue the dialogue after this show is over, that's where I am.
But Nicholas Johnson, if we know that propaganda works, Joseph Goebbels demonstrated that. What mechanism do we have at a grassroots level that is a counterweight to this slick propaganda from the right-wing media? In other words, how do you de-anesthetize the American people?
Well, that's tough. I mean, you do it by supporting your program in Pacifica. You do it by sending money to other groups as well that are working in this area. The Center for Public Integrity had a wonderful piece on Bill Moyers Now a couple Fridays ago, which reached even more millions of people. We've had, of these 500,000 messages that have reached the FCC, many of them have come by email, and George Stephanopoulos this morning, in interviewing Michael Powell, said something like 98% of them were adamantly opposed to the rules change.
By the way, Michael Powell avoided going on Nightline, had canceled at the last minute. He's not exactly made himself very available. And frankly, the only time that you've had people from the side of the media in this debate, not that the media have gone out of their way to cover this, they haven't. They've actually stayed away from it. But McNeil Lair had an NBC lawyer on, and he literally made no sense. There was the moguls don't even have an argument.
Yes,
when they step up to the plate, they have nothing to say.
Particularly when you realize that the standard the FCC is still supposed to apply is public convenience, interest, and necessity. Now, that doesn't say much, but what I argued as an FCC commissioner was that at a minimum, that has to mean something more than profit maximizing, because you get profit maximizing with no regulatory standard at all. And so it has to mean something above and beyond that, and my argument was it has to mean that any change in an ownership standard bears a very heavy burden of proof as to how the public is benefited by it. You don't resolve the issue by having the advocates say, well, I don't see any harm's going to come from it. Now, I think we can identify a lot of harm that comes from it. But they can't just say no harm comes from it. They have to show how is the public measurably better off as a result of letting Clear Channel own, you say 1,200 radio stations. And I just don't think that anybody's even tried to meet that standard, but they certainly haven't met it.
Somebody wanted to jump in there. Was it John or Bob?
It was me. And I just wanted to throw in one other thing here. Just to emphasize your point about the lack of coverage. I have been interviewed over the last year on media issues just on this station 5 times. That means that you have provided more coverage of this debate than ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox combined over this period, right up to this week. Now, in this week, when it is almost impossible to stop the train from rolling, a number of the major media outlets have started to cover it. But you realize that up until this week, this was a virtually uncovered story. On the day of the single public hearing that was held on these rule changes, the Pew Center put out a study where they asked Americans, a large sampling of Americans, what do you know about these changes? More than 75% knew nothing. They hadn't heard a word about it. Now, here's the interesting thing on the other side, though. Of those who had heard about it, the opposition was so overwhelming that it was irrelevant to measure support. And this fits with on Lou Dobbs' Moneyline, one of the few shows that's talked about this recently, a very conservative audience to that show. I mean, there's no question that those are basically investors who like to watch that show. They asked, should the FCC go ahead with these rule changes? 98% of the people who responded said no. It was the most overwhelming margin that they had had. If they had said, should Saddam Hussein be made president of the United States, they would have had more support for that than they could have found for these rule changes.
Let me ask you, because
the lack of coverage is the only thing that is allowing these rule changes to go forward.
If people
knew about it, it would be a major issue.
Sure. Let me just quickly ask Bob Williams at the Center for Public Integrity. As Commissioner Nicholas Johnson mentioned, there was a piece on Bill Moyers about it. I mean, do you have a feeling that there is a way to get this attention out? Because, I mean, the right-wing media, as I say, and in terms of the politics in this country, they just don't want to have a debate and have a two-party system. They want it all. And the Fox people, particularly this O'Reilly guy, is conducting a vendetta against Bill Moyers. He's calling on to investigate his funding it through PBS. He had Billy Towson, the guy from the Congress who's the chair that has oversight over the FCC, joining him, saying, "Yeah, we got to get these guys. We got to get these guys." I mean, this is an amazing how much the goalposts have been moved to the right. But do you have any sense that there is a growing constituency of awareness out there?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's really ramped up here in the last week or so. Unfortunately, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference now. This commission is going to vote tomorrow on a 3-2 vote on these rules, which it's really interesting. Nobody except these commissioners and their staff have even seen these rules yet. And this gets to something that is really, you all were talking about, how do you reach people and find out about this. This process was conducted almost completely in secret. There was one public hearing, as John says. There were all these private meetings that they held with industry folks. This just strikes at anybody who takes democracy seriously, that the public's business should be done in public. This has not happened at the SEC on this issue at all. And if I can plug our website just for a minute, because I think we have a very valuable tool for people who want to know more about their particular situation and whether they should be upset. We put together a database that will show you, if you punch in your zip code or your city name, exactly who owns the media, the television stations, the radio stations, and most of the newspapers in the country in your town. And when people see that, almost always they are shocked by the fact how much consolidation has already taken place in the media. And it's been a really valuable tool in getting people's attention to say, wait a minute, this isn't some thing that's happening in Washington away from me and doesn't affect me. This is my hometown of Birmingham, Alabama, or Santa Fe, New Mexico. And, gosh, Rupert Murdoch and Clear Channel already own so much here.
Well, isn't there, let me ask Nick Johnson this, isn't there a clear potential here if you have basically the only source of information in all of those states that went red in the last election? You know, you had the blue states on the West Coast and on the East Coast, and the whole center and the South are red. Doesn't that almost guarantee that they will always stay red as long as that's the only source of information they get?
Well, obviously, it has an enormous impact on what people think, at a minimum, what it is they're thinking about. For those who continue to talk about the liberal media, I always like the bumper sticker, the liberal media are as liberal as their conservative owners permit them to be. And I would just ask, you can find commercial radio stations in those red states where you can hear Rush Limbaugh, followed by Gordon Liddy, followed by Ollie North, followed by Michael Reagan. And I challenge you to find a commercial radio station where you can hear Jim Hightower, followed by Molly Ivins, followed by Jesse Jackson, followed by Ralph Nader. I think anybody who does not recognize what's happening here in terms of this, I use the Mussolini analogy, the Council of Corporations along with the government moving to the right, just isn't being honest in terms of what's happening.
Billions and billions are being spent to beguile and dumb down the American people. Let me get with you, Bob, for a last minute. Any ways to exhort the audience into activism here?
Well, I'm a big fan of public radio, and we're nonpartisan, and I hope that support of public radio is nonpartisan as well. I would ask people to come to our website, www.publicintegrity.org. We put together what we feel is a pretty good group of tools that people who want to get involved in this issue and want to stay involved in this issue can look at. And we're going to be we're on a 3-year project on this, so we're not stopping anytime soon.
And John Nichols, the author of Our Media, Not Theirs, a quick minute from you.
Sure. First off, we're probably going to lose the fight tomorrow, but I like to emphasize to people this is a battle in a very long war. Nick Johnson told us, he was talking about the fight back in the 1920s. I think that the right and the corporatists and their politicians reached too far this time, and they have inspired an angry coalition that will make media an issue. So far from being depressed tomorrow, I hope that we celebrate, because this is the point at which we are really going to begin the fight back. And I'll do one final thing, and that is emphasize, Bob McChesney and I called our book Our Media, Not Theirs. The our in that is the great mass of people. The theirs is a handful of big corporations. And I can't think of a better example of how our media ought to work than this station we're talking on right now. That alternative is going to be more necessary than ever. Help us to build the movement that will take back our media and make it our media, not theirs.
A last minute from former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson.
Thank you so much, Ian. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your wonderful program. So well regarded by those of us who listen on the internet as well as those in Los Angeles. I want to encourage people to go to the Center for Public Integrity's website. That is a wonderful resource, and I can endorse that as someone who's not a member of their organization but admires what it is they're doing. I think the things we can do, get on the web, find the sites, find the organizations, put them in your favorites links. Send them email, send them your financial support, get on their listservs when they've got action alerts. You could have participated, if you haven't already, in the 500,000 people who contacted the FCC on this issue. There's a lot that you can do. Check my website, www.nicholasjohnson.org. And it's a lot of fun as well as absolutely essential if we're going to preserve democracy. But don't minimize the fun you can have at feeling some power and ability to help affect these issues.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Ian, for bringing us together. It was a great hour.
Thank you very much. So all three of you gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. And I've got people to thank, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. So again, thank you very much. Bye.